Blog Talk Radio. Gentlemen, and welcome to the backyard. This is Margaret Marshall, your host, and I'm thrilled to be live again. As most of our fans know, we had sort of taken a short vacation, and we replayed some of our shows, and believe me, they were so popular, lots of hits. So I guess that some people just was not around when those shows was made. So on that light, I'd like to tell you that tonight I'm very excited because we have a very special guest. But before we do that, let's all take our virtual trip to the island. Remember, this is a Labrish. And as we gathered on our verandas or in our backyards or on the beach, in a hammock, on a stool or whatever, we could feel the gentle trade winds just drift across our face. And no matter how hot and sizzly it was during the day, you bet it would be cooling down by this. So we'll just pretend that for those of us who might not make it back there to enjoy this the beautiful weather and the sweet smell of the flowers and the chirping of the birds, let's take a virtual trip. So while we do that, I'll tell you a little bit about our special guest tonight. He is Mr. Gladstone Meyer. And I would like to read you what he says about himself. Well, at the time of this bio, I suppose he was 81 years young, very active, and don't look a day older than 50. I love that. Now, Mr. Meyer was born in a small town in Montego Bay, and we're going to be chatting a little with him in a nanosecond about some of his experiences growing up in Montego Bay. And I remember when I first spoke to this gentleman, he asked me about Kingston, or I think he mentioned about me talking about Kingston most of the time. And I told him because I was a Kingstonian. And most of my guests that were on regularly were also Kingstonians. So, you know, I am quite thrilled, and I must confess that I left Jamaica in 1959, and I had never been to Montego Bay. I did not go to Montego Bay until I returned to the island 7 years later, and the plane stopped in Montego Bay. And I did fall in love with Montego Bay, too, because I ended up building a house there. So I am just so thrilled to have a Montegonian on tonight, and I see that the board is full. So I want to welcome all my guests who are calling in. I really missed you very much, and I hope you did too. So we're going to get right into opening up the mic, and we'll talk a little bit about Mickey, as he's fondly called, Mickey's bio as we go through. But he's on the board, so let me welcome him in. Hello, your mic is open, sir. Good evening.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
And would you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, and hello to all.
Good. And where are you calling from?
I'm at home here in Pembroke Pines, Florida.
Oh, I noticed you said home.
Well, partly home. I'm from Jamaica, and so Jamaica is my real home.
Uh-huh.
But I reside here at Pembroke Pines.
Okay. Well, no apologies, because I tell everyone I've been here longer, especially here that I live in Georgia. I've been in Georgia longer than I've lived in Jamaica.
Yes.
But, you know, we cannot get the love of Jamaica out of our veins. And I really don't, except for going back to visit, I really don't plan to spend the rest of my life there. You know, I'll go for a short vacation now and then. But I still have wonderful memories, and I consider myself blessed, just blessed, to be born on the beautiful island of Jamaica. So I would like
to... Montego Bay.
Beg your pardon?
You should have been born in Montego Bay.
Oh, no, that is all right. But I must tell you, may I call you Mickey?
Sure, certainly.
Okay. I must tell you that my family was from Savlamar, you know, Savannah Lamar's really, but, you know, we call it Savlamar. And
yes.
Funnily, we call it Sav. And I used to go to Negril quite often, but just never got over to Montego Bay, you know, when I was young and younger. But I'm sure, as you know, during the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, we didn't have the communication that we have now. We didn't have the transportation that we have now. And we didn't have the roads that there is now
yes.
in Jamaica. So things have changed drastically.
My grandfather was from Westmoreland, Little London. And the
yes, I'm familiar with
father's
Little London.
Side, and my
yes,
father's
yes.
side, they all grew up in Savlamar.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So, yes. Who knows? Perhaps my people know your people.
Quite possible. But,
so let me just tell our listeners, and believe you me, there are lots of listeners on tonight. They're anxious
Very
to hear
good.
Mickey. I want to welcome 718-973-404-305. Welcome all on the board tonight and those listening online. And let me just remind all the listeners now and those who might come along later that you're listening to Backyard Labrish on Blog Talk Radio. We're here each week at 8 o'clock where we celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. So with that said, I am going to turn the mic over to Mickey so he can share with us some of his experiences with growing up in Montego Bay. He's a Montegonian. And I must invite anyone on the board that would like to interact with Mickey and I. Just hit 1 on your telephone. And I will see a raised hand, and I'll open up the mic, because that's what a Labrish is. This is not a strict platform, not a political platform. We're just here to have fun, reminisce, and leave some memories, living memories. So, Mickey, you want to tell us a little bit? It mentioned here that your mom was from her grandfather.
Yeah, we're all mixed up there.
Yes. But, you know, earlier on I had done when different races or cultures arrived in Jamaica. You know, the Jews arrived and the Germans, and but I never, apparently there was not a large amount of people from Scotland.
Scotland and Ireland.
Right.
And Welsh.
There was an article about the Irish when there were some political problems there, and of course the famine that
they came to work on the plantations too.
Right.
Straw bosses and what have you.
Right. So, but I don't know, were there a lot of, do you know if there were a lot of people from Scotland?
Not too many, sprinklings of.
Sprinklings, right.
But
if
I may, with your permission,
sure.
Just read a paragraph from one of the books that I have published about Manteca Bay.
Okay,
may
and
I?
The title is?
Beyond the Fence.
Beyond the Fence.
Yes. You know, they have a lot of zinc fence in Manteca Bay.
Right.
Okay, the real Manteca Bay. For those listeners who haven't gone to Manteca Bay or wasn't born in Manteca Bay, this is a little story of the old Manteca Bay.
Okay.
When it was a jewel. Manteca Bay was a jewel, a work of art, relaxing on any of its white sandy coral beaches, forever can be seen across the aqua blue waters, caressed by nature's natural bay. A falling mountain range, gentle dips into the sweet Caribbean, almost 60 miles of visibility. The hills that rise from the beaches with the lush green foliage create a picture book background for this adorable scenery. This tranquil and beautiful little village has attracted to its shores sailors of English and Spanish origin, pirates, racketeers, and merchants. What a mighty web it has spawned, a playground for the rich and powerful from the time of Columbus, a little patent place in its own right. From the architecture of old buildings to the monuments that adorn the walls of the old parish church, from the headstones of the old Jewish cemetery to the buried chains of slavery in the town square, all speak of a rich and diverse past. There you got it.
Wonderful. That is wonderful. And, you know, I built a house in Manteca Bay, so I remember that. I know that cemetery you're talking about.
Well, there were two.
Uh-huh.
There were two Jewish cemeteries.
Right,
but let me fill you on a little history of Manteca Bay. The word Manteca Bay actually started out as Manteca from the Spanish who were there before. And the Manteca, they used the word Manteca because it meant fat, lard. And they had a lot of wild boars in around the hills and mountains of Manteca Bay. So that's where they used to get the lard and the fat for their lamps and of theirs. Their ships.
Wow.
So, you know, there are a lot of wild boars there.
Uh-huh.
Now Manteca Bay consists of seven hills. Most people don't know that.
I didn't know that.
Okay. There's seven hills. There's Red Hills, Howard Hill, Richmond Hill, Mount Salem, Bogue Hill, Jacksontown, and Brandon Hill.
Now, I know the one you just called, because there's a road that go through it. That's always very dangerous when we're traveling on it.
Up in Red Hills?
No, it's another one. You further down in the list.
Okay, it's the Bogue Hills or Brandon Hill?
No, it's another one.
Jacksontown? That's a different Jacksontown, you know, than the one in Trelawney.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So seven hills.
Seven hills.
Wow.
And at the foot of Jackson Town is the beginning of a spring. And that spring was called the creek. It's just a creek.
Uh-huh.
And they later built a monument at the head of the creek. And people used to say, Merrymaids lived in there.
Oh, interesting.
But
very,
the creek
very interesting.
Was the creek was the source of water for this little town.
And before, which town was that?
Montego Bay.
Oh,
that's where
wow.
everybody used to go with their pan on their heads and go
uh-huh.
and fetch water.
Right.
And
I'm sure it was clear spring water.
Oh, my, clear crystal.
Uh-huh.
And as boys, we used to get little shrimp out of it, or crayfish, as they
uh-huh.
called it, until they built a reservoir up on the top of Richmond Hill, and they used gravity to supply the town. But many days, the water cut off. People still go there with a pan on their head to get water.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly enough, the creek formed a dividing line between the to-dos and the don'ts.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Are you talking about the haves and the have-nots?
That's right. If you
I like the way you put it, the to-dos and the to-don'ts.
We are lavishing.
This is lavish. The haves and the have-nots. Okay. So it's sort of separated.
Listen, it's a demarcation line. Everything that's built in Montego Bay is on the north side of the creek. The courthouse, the hospital, the churches, the homes, they're all on the north side of Montego Bay.
Oh, interesting.
And that's where all the English people, Scottish people, Welsh people lived, plus their concubines and their sweethearts and their illegitimate children.
On the other side of the creek?
On the north side of the creek.
Ah.
The big English parish church, the back of it is to the creek. And it wasn't kept up. It was all bush at the time.
Right.
Now,
interesting.
On the other side of the creek is where the Bonnet Sugar Estate comes in.
Oh.
And that's where, after slavery, a lot of people gravitated to that area from the country to come and be in Montego Bay.
I see.
Now, you have the African descents on the left southern side of the creek and the English and European descent on the right side of the creek.
Wow.
Now, there wasn't enough white women for the English or Scottish or Irish men, so they went with black women.
Uh-huh.
And that started a whole set of new people. And all the prejudices and backbiting that went on.
I see.
Those
the
people.
The do's and the to don'ts.
They were lavishing, baby. We're lavishing.
Yeah.
Those people that didn't want to go over the creek to get a black man, they remained old maids.
Oh.
Every street in that little 10-block area always had two sisters as old maids.
Oh, really?
Yes. On Union Street, on King Street, on Orange Street, I could name names, but
we would call those the Puritans.
They wind up with as old maids for the concubines for some of the men.
Right.
My mother was a brown skin, and she went across. She went across
because her grandmother went over the creek.
Yeah, she went over the creek.
I see. Mm-hmm. In the old days, they would say, "Story a come to bump."
Yes.
You remember that saying?
I tell you, my mother was how would I say, a realist.
Uh-huh.
One of her grandchildren asked her, says, "Grandma, how do you manage?" She's from America. The children are from America. "How do you manage having two illegitimate children? How do you live like that?" And you know what she said? "Child,
uh-huh.
I wasn't going to come out the world the same way I came in."
Wow.
That is tenacity and strength.
Yes.
And that same strength hand was handed down to me.
Wonderful.
Because I was in between.
Mm-hmm.
In between. And so life for me as a boy in Montego Bay was no bed of roses. Because those little brown-skinned kids and all that don't want to talk to you, don't want to play with you, because they think they're better than you.
Right.
And the idea for the fence was I could not go to Cornwall College. My mother didn't have enough money.
So it was money, not necessarily that you were up there on the side of the fence. Okay.
And I couldn't go. And the little private school I used to go to before with all of them, at 11 years old, they started going to Cornwall College. And I couldn't go. And these little devils won't even talk to me anymore. So I would have to, my mother would send me out to buy a little piece of bread at the store, at the shop in the mornings. And they're going up the hill to Cornwall College. They had to pass my house.
Right.
And I had to hide behind a fence. And one day I said to myself, damn it, they ain't better than me. I'm going to step out of this fence. And I made one step. And step by step, I haven't stopped stepping yet.
Wow.
And it has got me to heights that I never expected to be. But coming back to Montego Bay, it is so full of history. The Jews were the first to get there.
Uh-huh.
They will
they
tell
the
you
first
that they
to
came
there
from England.
In Kingston, too.
Yes. They will tell you they came from England. But no, they came from Spain.
They came from some of them came from Portugal.
Portugal, okay. Mm-hmm. Because of the Inquisition.
Right.
When I was a boy and went to parish church, there was a man named Hart from the Hart family.
Right.
A Jewish man. And he's reading the gospel in church. And later on I grew up and I said, well, what was he doing there?
Yeah.
Because they had their synagogues in Kingston.
Right.
But it was what they brought over from Spain. Because if they never converted to Christianity, they would be put in chains.
Right. We did a show on that. Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, was behind all of that.
And believe me, honey, they own the town.
Uh-huh.
They own the town until Syrians start coming in. And we had names in that town like Hart, which, of course, you know they changed their name from Hartstein to Hart. But the Harts and the Levines and the Levies and the Ewings and the Cars. Ethel is a Jewish name.
Uh-huh.
Ethel Hart had a hotel on top of City Center. Then you have the Ilders and Hiltons and the Elamars and the Dillises and the Hannahs and the Ewans. They were all those people of some standard in the town.
I see.
They had then you had Walter Fletcher. He's an English or Canadian or Englishman. He owned most of the waterfront. And the waterfront was only owned by four families.
Mm-hmm.
Carr and Company and Eldemeyer and Standard Wharf and the Food Company, United Food Company.
Right.
And they controlled. Now in the lower part of the North Gully, there's a big gully, North Gully, almost to the sea. It was called Gigi Beach. Gigi Beach.
Wow.
There's a family named Gigi, Mr. Gigi.
I got you.
And they call it Gigi Beach. Now in that area you had 3-story buildings, all frame.
Now what year approximately we're talking?
1930, 35, 37, 40,
okay.
Up until 45.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, great.
And they were fishermen, and they worked the big boats when the ship came in harbor, and they had to row the boats out to the big ship.
There were, what do they call them?
Stevedores?
Sea pilots.
Yes, that's where they lived. And, surprisingly, they used to have a lot of conch, skunkjili, that used to get out the waters of creek. They take the conch out, and they had high mountains of shells.
Wow.
And those shells were ammunition.
Really? For what?
I'm going to tell you. No police or any law of people could come over in Gigi Beach.
Really?
Listen. Plus, they had Fletcher, who's an Englishman. They had a minister, who's an Englishman. You had a chief of police, who's an Englishman. Nobody could touch those people because they were protected by Fletcher.
Oh. So and how did the conch shells come in?
They used a stone. They used the ammunition.
Oh, so that
they
could
stone.
Cut you really bad.
Oh, yes. Bad, bad, bad.
Oh. So
but
they
when
were
I talk about the
bullets.
Gangsters, those were the gangsters. They owned the bay. Listen, old Fletcher used to dress in white linen three-piece suits with a chain, a pocket chain watch, and a gold-tipped cigarette and two-toned shoes. I mean, you had to admire the man.
Wow.
You had to admire the man. He married to a woman who was a Canadian. And what used to happen in Montego Bay that most people don't know, follow the money. There are two banks, Bank of Nova Scotia and the Bank of Canada. It is said that it was the first time any bank had leave their homeland to go offshore. There was a reason for those two banks to be in Manteca Bay. Nobody knew. But at that time, in the 30s and the 40s, in the months of October till April, they had yachts. I mean, smokestack yachts. English and Canadian people. 25, 30 yachts in the harbor of Manteca Bay for the whole winter.
You mean they were snowbirds? They were
yes.
getting away from the snow.
Not only that. Not only that. That's why the banks were in Manteca Bay.
Ah.
It is alleged that the sale of opium from China was being shuttled down into those banks.
Oh,
they washed
really?
The money there. Exactly. But
you mean it was like money laundry?
Yeah.
The laundry.
That's right. But it created a whole lot of merchant tailors and dressmakers and all that. As a little boy, they used to get a little van and take the tourists to my house. My mother would make dresses for them for the winter, pocketbooks. And the merchant tailors were respectable gentlemen because they were making and fitting suits and all that for these wealthy people.
Wow.
Then they had the Lascelles tour cars with the canvas back, all the way back.
Wow.
And and you could see them touring, the drivers in their stiff white shirt and black ties. I mean, properly attired, driving these cars through town to go over in the countryside. And here's these men in their three-piece linen suit, women in their floral dresses and hat and gloves. Fantastic to see. Well,
wow.
Well,
those were the dress-up days.
Yes. On the other side, the local people, there was a woman named Miss Rod. She had a daughter who became principal of Kingston Central School. She was a newspaper of the town. She walked from street to street telling people what happened in the town the day before.
Oh, the town crier.
Exactly. This is what is happening. The control of Montego Bay were, as I said, the English people.
Uh-huh.
And whatever banks were there, you couldn't get a loan unless you went to the parson. The parson.
To the minister?
The minister had to okay. And so you got, speaking of those two banks, when Jamaica got its independence in 1960-something, those two banks sold out to Jamaican interests, and they went to Grand Cayman.
Ah.
See?
The party was over.
The party was over.
Okay.
Party was over. In coming back to the local people, at least at that time, the only people that could vote was landowners. You had to have your title of your land, and then you could vote. And so
right.
They had meetings in the square. Everything happened in the square, in the courthouse. Behind the courthouse was the food market. On Friday nights, your mother would take you, be so glad to be free to run around late at night buying sugar cane and fruits, whatever you could get, in the market. Behind the market now was the utility house, the big powerhouse that supplied electricity to the town with its big diesel engines and all that. That was the Montego Bay I knew.
Now,
the Jewish people had haberdasheries and drugstores and what have you, but some local people had theirs too. There was a man named Greenspence. He had he was an atheist. He had a drugstore, and an old beggar came in one day and begged him for some money. He went in his pocket, and threw out a few coins, and gave it to the beggar. The beggar says, "Thank you, God. Thank you, God." He said to the man, "Come here, come here, come here. God didn't give you that money. I did. Give me back my money."
That's funny. So let me ask you something. What age were you when you left there?
I was 21 when I left Montego Bay.
So you grew up entirely there?
Yes.
So during your, like, teenage years, how did you socialize? Did they have parties, dances, you went to clubs or what?
Yes,
what did
yes.
you do in Montego Bay? We know what we did in Kingston.
Well, listen, the courthouse was a place where everybody had dances. On every holiday, there would be dances.
In the courthouse?
In the courthouse.
Oh,
there's
we
a big
that
hall
one.
There. And the courthouse, you'd have dances. And it was got so hot, if you live close by, you run up and change your shirt, if you had a shirt to change. But that was where we had our dances. And, of course, we went looking for girls on Friday night, the country girls coming down with their parents, and you, as a young boy, trying to get a little something, and that's where you go. Besides,
what was the music like?
The music was...
Was it mento?
No. Well, we had the mento, and we had a guy named Lyo who could play the banjo over his back. But usually the dance things were American music. They had their saxophone and drums and trumpets.
In the 40s?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, we had an all-woman band came there. And they played at the Guild Club. Now, the Guild Club was also another place of snobbery because it was all of these half-breeds who were members there, so you couldn't. They made a little club on the other side called Mobe Club. That was for the local people. Well, those other people were local also, but that's the dividing line.
There were the haves.
They were the haves.
Okay.
And
to do's.
And Dr. Morrison, bless his heart, his father was a headmaster of the boys' school in Montego Bay, and he sent his son away to America to become a doctor. And he came back and be a doctor. And he went to I think he went to med school in Ireland and came back with an Irish wife.
Uh-huh.
And went to the Gill Club. And these little half-breeds turned to her, dancing with her, and says, how come you're married to this man, this black man?
Uh-huh.
Well, he heard, and he's a big fella. And he gave him a straight right hand.
Really?
Cool. Okay. These are the things that went on in Manteca Bay.
Wow. And so what I hear you saying, that most of the tourists were these people coming in their yachts.
In their yachts at the time.
At the time,
now,
yes.
Now,
because there
now,
wasn't an airport there, was there?
No, no, there was no airport. There was no airport.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Scave was given to the town by a man, a doctor named Dr. McKetty.
Uh-huh.
And he had rheumatic pains, and he said that he would go in the sand over there, it will help him. So there's a little cave right under the jump diving board, and that's where he used to go, he and his friends. Now,
uh-huh.
There was a man, I don't know his name, but they said in the history, the Hearts wrote something, a piece, some time ago about the history of Jamaica and Manteca Bay. There was a gentleman who rode a white horse, wore a white suit every morning and went to Doctor's Cave and came back. And at that time, women were not allowed to go in Doctor's Cave Beach, maybe because of their dress or their attire. It was not until those yachts start coming
Mm-hmm.
that the Canadian and English woman was open up for them. Other than that, little black me couldn't go to Doctor's Cave Beach. It was when Manley came in and he says, wherever the high tide goes, that's government property. You cannot stop people from coming in. That's why Doctor's Cave Beach was opened up.
I see.
The rest of the beaches along that strip were cemeteries.
Interesting.
They were all cemeteries. And that's where local people used to go, take the clothes off under the almond, the grape tree, and swim in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the Morro people, peanut people from America, started coming to Jamaica, they bought the cemetery. And they dug up all those graves and transferred them into a place called Pie River on the other side of town.
Really?
All that hotel, the Montego Beach Hotel, was built on cholera ground. It was all cholera ground. My mother told me that when cholera came in the turn of the century, people were just dying like flies. They had a wagon that walked around with a bell and light. You have a dead, they take it and they take it out and bury them.
Oh, it was a cholera outbreak.
But I tell you something, they never touched the Jewish cemetery. And the Jewish cemetery is there until today. And there was another one on Union Street, up in Union Street. Most people don't know that. But behind Dr. Morrison's property, there was a cemetery. And that was a Jewish cemetery.
Oh, interesting.
Coming back to entertainment. You know, going to school, 14, 15, 16, because you don't go further than 16 years old, they used to have midday concerts at the Strand Theater. And school boys and girls used to go and listen to symphonic music and all that. Wide New Horizon. So we were not known local two-bit. And I tell you something, most of the youngsters from Manteca Bay that I know about that went to the elementary school turned out to be beautiful citizens wherever they went.
Progressive
people.
Right, right. Well, I wanted to tell our listeners a little bit about how you, not how necessarily how you grew up, but how you blossomed. Oh, would you like to do it yourself?
Yes, 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 yes. It's a story. It's a story by itself.
Okay.
I'll tell you about Montego Bay as a patent place.
Uh-huh.
Now, my father went to Cuba as a boy, 14, 15 years old, like many others, to cut sugar cane.
Uh-huh.
But he was one of the ambitious ones. He came back with a trade.
Uh-huh.
A sheet metal worker. Don't call him a tinsmith. Call him a sheet metal worker. Because he came back with a lot of tools.
Right.
A lot of big tools, and he opened a little factory. He was
uh-huh.
a handsome devil. And he saw my mother, and she's a pretty woman. Nice, petite. And he banged her up.
Uh-huh.
That's me.
Okay.
Now, that devil, looking for prestige and position, married to a school teacher whose parents had Bethlehem College in Malvern.
Ah.
So he thought he was rising in position. He married her 10 days before I was born.
Wow.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
Legitimacy is all right, but in a small town, she had to come off the choir and all things like that, and she suffered a little bit of embarrassment. But his wife had the best school in town as a
uh-huh.
private school.
Uh-huh.
And she sent me there in my kindergarten years.
Ah.
Now, she was playing a little game to throw it back into her face. I don't know. But I suffered the consequences. Because this woman did not like me. And like God would have it, she couldn't have children.
Wow.
And they wanted to adopt me. And my mother says, my pretty boy, no, no, no. You can't have him.
Uh-huh.
And I remember until today, the slaps in the back of my, and she was a big woman, the slaps in the back of my neck when I can't pronounce a word or a sentence. And I fall on the ground and I see Peenie Wallace.
Really?
And
huh.
at 11, all those little boys and girls that I grew up with, to 11 years old, we had to go get the entrance exam to go to Cornell College.
Uh-huh.
Now, I understand, a young child is happy that he's going to go to Cornell College. And she says, no, you're not going to take the exam.
Really?
So, yeah, because my father would have to pay for me to go to Cornell College.
Uh-huh.
So there she retarded my progress.
Right.
But, you know something? As I grow older, I says, in every act, there is an ounce of good. There's a seed in there.
Yes.
And I've gone to Cornell College, and my friend Vernon says, you probably be a damn thief. But I walked from behind that fence. These were the boys that passed me. Didn't want to talk to me no more. And I passed them that day, 1, 2, 3, 4 of them. And I looked them dead in the eye, and I says, I'm going to turn out better than all of you. Today, at 81, my dear, I have written 9 volumes and published.
Wow, that is great.
I traveled the world, building restaurants in Africa, volunteering in Africa. I have traveled and I've done a whole lot. At 19 years old, I borrowed a little money from a lawyer with a little title from my mother, and we had a little two-room house, and I extended the house. You should see the look on her face when it was done. Happy.
You were the only child?
No, she had one girl before. One girl,
uh-huh.
older than she. And she had gone to America. An uncle of ours had sent for her, and she went to America when I was 9 years old. So I was basically alone, and I had to seek out friends. I seek out this fellow, Alan Payne. He was epileptic, and nobody wanted to be his friend. And I was his friend. And we would stay on his veranda on Barney Street, and we would read the Reader's Digest from cover to cover every month and wherever we could get something to read. And when I grow a little older, I ask a friend, I need to learn things. And he introduced me to the library.
Mm.
And the first book I read was something about dropping a pebble in a pond and watching the ripples go out and back to the center. And that has been my life. That has been the pattern of my life. I remember when I first came to America, and I was going to engage a young lady. We had an engagement party. Another woman was so jealous. I was a good-looking boy. Very jealous. She went to the immigration and says, he's working without a permit. They came and arrested me and deported me to Jamaica.
Really?
Yes. Because I
worked. Now, was the woman that reported you, was she an American woman?
No. She was a Jamaican.
Really?
That's Jamaican. But you know something? Today, I look back at it, and in my books, I write about forgiveness, and I thank her. Because.
Is she still on the planet?
Yes, I think so. I think so.
Okay.
But the interesting thing about that scene was when I went to the embassy, this man told me, he said, you could marry 10 times. You ain't going back to America. The young lady came to Jamaica and we got married. You're not going anywhere. 4 years of going to the embassy every 2 weeks or 3 weeks to tell me there's no papers here for you. And in 4 years, I said to them, something's wrong here. Go get me so-and-so. And I went there. And I showed them the papers, what the United States government overturned. And I watched him. It was a big open office at the time. I watched him. He told the young lady, she went to a cabinet, bent down her knees, take out a file and blew the dust off it.
Wow. So
but
it was
you know
there
the
all
beauty,
the time.
You know the beauty in it all? That somebody's out here is watching over you? Had I gone back to America right after I got married, it takes 3 months for you to go back, I would have been drafted in the Korean War. And with my tenacity and push and drive, I'd be a dead son of a gun by now. When I finally came back into the United States, I was over the draft age.
Interesting.
I saw the woman 6 months after I came back in a restaurant that I was working. And when I came around the corner and saw her, the food dropped out of her mouth. And all the running back to Kingston every week, and I had no money going on a truck in dust and dirt and sweat came up. I was about to kill her. I almost. And she ran out of that restaurant.
Wow.
But today, I look back at my life and I said, hey, the good Lord
it was
and the universe had other things for me to do.
Right. Well, you know, there's a passage in the Bible, and I'm not into the religious thing, but I remember it makes so much sense that you meant it for evil or
yes.
He meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. So although it might have seemed to be an evil act, it kept you out of the war.
That determination of moving from behind the fence,
right?
That tenacity, that arrogance, because I was arrogant. I was going to move mountains. When I came back, in 1955, I worked at Lundy's Brothers, the largest restaurant in the world, and I operated a strike on the 4th of July, 1957, 300 waiters. Mickey Mailer, in charge of a strike for 300 waiters, the largest restaurant in the world. And, you know, I went on like that. We got into the union. There was no union before. We got into the union. We had a big dinner, fundraising dinner at the Jewish Center, Forest Hill Jewish Center.
Mm-hmm.
Big hall, over 1,000 people. And Senator Fulbright was a guest speaker. And I'm going to tell you how people respected me. I took my mother and my wife. And when they began to call names out for you to pledge, I was the third name on the list. I got up and I pledged my $200 and sat down, and my mother pinched me under the table, and I pinched her back.
Ah.
Pride and love and happiness.
Yes.
That I brought to an aging woman.
Yes.
And she always say, I want to see in your own business. I want to see in your own business. And, you know, I lived, I traveled, I went to Europe a couple of times on vacation, and then I had my first child in 1973.
Uh-huh.
And the
73.
Change. Yes, 1963, sorry.
Oh,
1963.
Okay.
And I was changing the Cadillacs every year, things the kind of, and I live a style of, well, I would say, not wealth, but there's that. I was a good dresser, and I had a couple of love lives and what have you, but all that ended when my daughter was born.
Oh.
And I said, she's going home to Jamaica to go to school, to live down there and have no complexes, whatever, that you can look at a person of another color and says, you ain't better than me.
Right,
And you can see it on the faces of Jamaican children today.
Right.
That amount of power that they have in themselves.
Yep.
And that was what took me back to Jamaica. I opened the Holiday Inn, the 500-room hotel, as a food and beverage director. And I stayed with them 3-4 months, and then I opened my own business. And I had my own Montagonian restaurant in Montego Bay, in Coral Gables, back in Montego Bay. That has been my life. That has been my life. I work hard, I played hard, and when I retired in 95, I was selected by the IESC, International Executive Service Corp. And that's a group that works directly with AID, the government AID, and Rockefeller Foundation. And they sent me to Zimbabwe to build two restaurants, to refurbish and build two restaurants. And I spent a couple of months there, came back, and I went back there again and opened another little disco for the people. And I met people. The lady who had in Zimbabwe was Madengo's daughter.
Really?
Madengo was the vice president of Kenyatta.
Right.
And Haile Selassie's great-grandnephew was at a house. We used to have brunch every Sunday. Oh, I met people of standing in that area.
Wonderful.
And being there, the ambassador, the American ambassador, his name was Johnny Johnson's, in Zimbabwe, we were invited as guests in his home many a time.
Right.
And I took that.
Well, tell me about the butterfly sanctuary.
Yes. I later came back home because a deal I was supposed to do in Zimbabwe fell through. And I came back, I didn't have anything to do, and I volunteered for the Peace Corps. I was the oldest member of the Peace Corps. And at the opening ceremony, they wanted me to speak on behalf of the group.
Uh-huh.
When I walked into that place, it was an old barracks, old army barracks, and one side was all the African people in their regalias of colors so beautiful and robed. And I got up to make my written speech, and something told me, says, listen, you're not going to go through this. And tears started welling up in my face. And I just spoke at my heart, and I said, you know, somebody like me, somebody who spoke like me, somebody who walked like me, who had mannerisms like me, lived here hundreds of years ago, was taken away from these shores in chains, and oh, how I suffered. But I'm back home in the cradle which once held me, home sweet home. The whole body of Africans got up and lift me and put me on their shoulder and walked me around the compound.
Wow.
It was the highlight of my trip.
Wow.
Anyway, I was in business, so they wanted something to do with tourism. And they put me in an area of Barbary Forest in the Shanty region, and I didn't know what to do. But while there in the forest, we see all these butterflies. You go in the old riverbed, and there are thousands of butterflies. And I went back to the forestry department, and I found out that they had 400 species of butterfly in the Barbary. But they shift from place to place, and it says, okay, we're going to build a sanctuary here for butterflies. And
wow.
I found out what kind of plants, what kind of flowers to plant, and I took a whole wilderness, and I held onto a big tree, and I says, please, God, show me how to make this butterfly sanctuary. And it came out to be one of the prettiest and largest butterfly sanctuaries in the world.
Isn't that wonderful?
And the little village of Kubasi, the village of Kubasi, was old and old zinc roof and all that, and that was the entrance. And I refurbished it. 9 shops. I built a wall from my pocket. Put a sign up says Akwaba. That's their sign. They don't say good morning or good evening. They say Akwaba means welcome. And I said in that speech, I says, I wonder what God have me here to do. What is my purpose here? And the purpose was to find 3 beautiful little children that I adopted and brought them to America. I could never leave them there.
Wow.
I was 70 at the time. I'm in the bush licking down mangoes with these children. Children singing in the house again. I had a nice house I lived in. I couldn't leave them there. I brought him here. The boy, in the 5 years he's here, he has got a full scholarship. He's going into mid school next term. And the 2 other girls, one want to be a pediatrician. The other one says she want to be an actress. They're still in high school.
Oh,
so I'm blessed.
Yes, you are.
I'm blessed.
So let me ask you something. Is that butterfly sanctuary still functioning?
My dear, when I went back in 6 years after to get these children, to my surprise and disappointment, it wasn't well kept.
Oh.
It wasn't well kept.
Oh, wow.
But what I'm blessed with is that I finished writing my books, my 9th book, and I felt a little useless because I have to be doing something. I run 3 miles every day, keep myself busy. And out of a clear blue sky, I got an email, and it says, we have something in common. In 1955, in the summer of 55, when I just came back here, my mother, so-and-so, and yourself had some connection. And she came back to South Carolina with a secret, and the secret was her.
Uh-huh.
I have found...
It was the person sending the email.
Yes. I found a 56-year-old woman who is my daughter. I picked myself up and I flew down to South Carolina. I met her. She's a spitting image of me.
Huh.
I don't even need to take a blood test or DNA. It is my child.
Isn't that interesting?
And that is the beginning of my 10th book that I'm working on right now.
Wait, how long ago was that?
This is 2 months ago.
2 months?
2 months
wow.
ago.
Wow. And may I ask, how old are you now?
I was 82 the 13th of April.
Oh,
this past
wow.
April.
Wow. That's so interesting.
I should answer you a different way, because when they ask my age, I usually say, I am old as the universe and young as the morning. But I'm 82.
Oh, that
don't
is
feel
impressive.
It. Don't act it. Don't live like it. And,
wow. Now, how old your mother was when she passed?
82.
82.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so she lived a long life to see you mature and come into your own.
You know, she always say, I want to see you in your own business. Oh, and, you know, they say when you die with a thought, it has a life. It has
uh-huh.
energy.
Right.
She died in June of 70. 1970 June.
Uh-huh.
And December, Christmas, New Year's Eve night, I opened my first restaurant.
Wow.
So she was right there helping me.
Yes. Hmm. Well, at this time, I'm going to ask listeners on the board if they'd like to ask you any questions or had any comments.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to first welcome the listeners listening online and to remind you that you're listening to Backyard Labrish on Blog Talk Radio. We're here every Wednesday at 8 o'clock where we celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. And tonight, we're having just a wonderful conversation with our guest, Mr. Gladstone Meyer, formerly called Mickey, who has just given us some wonderful history about Montego Bay. So I am just thrilled because this is the first time I get to interview a Montegonian, as they're called. And incidentally, I read where that was the name of your restaurant,
yes,
Mickey.
Yes.
Oh, good choice.
May I take a minute to introduce you to something? There is a group of people from Montego Bay that's having a function here in Fort Lauderdale on Sunday, May 29th.
Ah.
All the Montegonians are getting together.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
I haven't heard the Kingstonians doing that, so I have a hint.
They're too busy doing other things.
Right, so may I ask, is it only Montegonians that are going to be there?
I don't think so, but may I put a plug in?
I'm sure Montegonians marry other people.
They can call
954-616-8138.
And I think that they can call, if I want to go, is 954-616-8138.
Thank you.
If they wish to attend.
We'd like to hear the titles of some of your books and tell us a little bit about what it's about and where it can be purchased.
Yes. You can go online to createspace.com or Amazon.com and punch in Gladstone D. Mailer Books and you get them all.
What would you spell the name so that people punch it?
Gladstone D initial Meyler.
Uh-huh.
And the first book that I quoted from was From Beyond the Fence, Behind the Fence, or From Beyond the Fence. The next one I wrote was Can the Desert Bloom Again?
Mm.
That, madam, is a striking story of one of my downfalls in business, and I went away to Africa in a way of hiding myself, not from my creditors, because I paid them all off, but to regain my life, and I did. That's important.
To bloom again.
To bloom again. And
okay.
All because the first restaurant I built there, they had a drought of 8 years. There was a little lily plant on the side of the road, and a young man came to me for a job, and I said to him, okay, yes, but you know what you do, son? You see this lily? Give it some water every morning. It was drooping. It was dying. And in less than 2 weeks, the lily bloomed, a shoot of bloom, instead of even putting out a leaf.
Wow.
And that gave me the inspiration to write this book.
Uh-huh.
That all we need is a little care and a little
right.
love. And we'll bloom.
Right.
Now, the next one is Unlocking the Mystery of Memory.
Uh-huh.
That, madam, is the book to read.
Uh-huh.
Because it goes into spiritualism and it's endless. And it takes you way back in time and before time.
Okay.
It's It started with the voice that you hear in your head as a companion. And
right.
It turned
still
out,
small voice.
It's a small voice. And I listened to that small voice. And I had a peach one day in the park, juicy peach, throw away the seed. And, you know, something tells me, hey, something is in that seed. And I laid on and I start thinking. I said, oh, my God, we are from a seed. This seed have all the things for it to grow and germinate and make another peach tree. Where, and ask the question, where do our seed go to germinate? We can't see it when it's here. It's invisible. So therefore, it has to be an invisible place where it goes to germinate.
Mm-hmm.
And that memory comes back with you when you're reborn.
Right.
So that is that. Then the next one is a fictional book. And I took 6 characters, fellas that I grew up with, and I turned it into 1 character, and the name of it is Mr. Delete.
Uh-huh.
And it started with someone going to England as a youngster and being a pimp on the streets of London in order to live.
Mm.
And turned out to be a man, an industrialist.
Mm.
That, and it's sort of fictional. The next one is The Twisted Metal, and it has to do with the Maroons.
Mm-hmm.
And the strength of the Maroons that outlived the British, that strength lived in their genes. And this particular Jamaican, he lived in Jamaica, he grew up in Jamaica, went into politics, and finally one of his children was going to marry to the president in line for Syria. So there was a color bit getting in there. So that's very, very intriguing. Very intriguing. The next one is a letter from a father to a son. This young man that I brought here at 18, he was so anxious to become a man, and he conjured up ideas of doing this and doing that, and I had to set him down and lecture him, and I wrote him a nice letter, and that I made into a book.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Then I went on to write a children's book, Voices from the Forest. And I got that from a cousin of mine by the name of Beres Ruddock. He said to me, you're writing, I would love you to write the story of the animals complaining to God. And I never did anything like that. And I got down and I asked the universe, I says, come on, help me with this book. And I wrote this book, Voices from the Forest. A little 5-year-old girl listening to the animals talk.
Mm.
And they were all complaining. She went to the zoo and she had them complain. Very interesting children's book.
Wow.
The other one is a deep one. It's a bit of poetry and composition, and it is analysis of a thought.
Mm.
Where a thought
you
comes
are
from.
Quite diverse.
Track a thought, track it down, and see where it leads you.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Very interesting.
I didn't go to Cowell College, but I'm here. Pumping
away.
Oh,
well, you went to someplace else.
I went to this college out here
when
in the world.
When did you publish your first book?
Last year. I had written 2-3 books, and I didn't publish them because it was costing too much money. And then I found an outlet where I could self-publish. And people print to order.
Right,
so,
right.
So I am with Create Space, and it's a connection of Amazon.com. And they can be had in the stores now. But if you go online, they'll send it out to you. And you can get it in ebook also.
Now,
so
did it take you to write your first book?
You know, the first one was, 25, 30 years ago. I wrote a chapter about my mother, Ellen, and my father, William, and myself growing up in Montego Bay, and I didn't do anything more than that. And a friend by the name of Dave Vernon, he sent some people down to Montego Bay to visit with me while I had my business. And every Sunday morning, we used to go to Joe James Gallery out in Rab, you know, and have a Jamaican breakfast.
Uh-huh.
And we brought back these people up to one of my restaurants called Mickey's. It's a sports bar, 30-seat Subkin sports bar. And I was telling them these stories, and I said, you know, and they were teachers. I said, you have enough here to write a book.
Mm.
And that same year, I got 2 free tickets from American Airlines to go see the soccer world games in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And I took a girlfriend of mine from Chicago, and we were doing nothing. We sat outside the home of, I can't remember the, it's a Christian Science Monitor, and they had a floating pool there. And she says, you know, this is the time to write this book. Went across the street and bought a tape recorder and started writing.
Wow.
Started writing. A very important thing happened in that book. I had a dream. And each time I try to record this dream, the recorder wouldn't work. And I said, maybe doesn't want it to do. And you know, I dreamed things 25 years before it happened.
Mm.
I dreamt that I can tell you now because it's out. I dreamt I was in outer space, looking down at Mother Earth, and beside me was a very fair maiden in pure white long dress, and she was holding up a wand in her hand, and we hugged. And at the top of the wand was a big diamond. And all of a sudden, we started to move at a terrific speed. Speed you can't imagine. And Earth was turning. And we turned into the diamond. She and I became the diamond.
Wow.
We landed in East Africa. And when I was closing up my business in Jamaica, 2 weeks before, these people called me from Connecticut and says, we hear so much about you. Would you like to go to Africa? I closed the restaurant that Saturday night. Sunday, I flew to Miami, where I had my home. And on Tuesday evening, I was on my way to London, going down to Zimbabwe, as fast as that.
Wow.
Fast as that.
And we're almost to the speed of the dream.
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
Before I came to America, I dreamt I was in a boat. It was going to bounce up and on rocks and break up. And out of the lighthouse came a man, stretched his hand, a white hair, bushy hair, white, wrinkled face old man, took me out of the boat.
Wow.
15 years later, when I came to America, I worked in a catering hall, which I never liked. And the labor chief says, go there, Brother Mailer. They like you. And they had a bar mitzvah. We were guests. And Irvin Birnbaum, which was one of the owners, and all the men dancing the aura, in front of me was this same dream, this man, Irving. When I came...
Wow.
Irving took me everywhere. He took me to Philharmonic Hall. He took me to Eddie Fisher Hall, Lincoln Center. His children played in symphonic bands. He took me to concerts. My wife and I, and he and his wife and his children, we go to the mountains. We shared a chalet over in Rockaway Beach. He took me out of the boat. And he was giving me money. He was helping me to make more money.
Wow.
In catering.
Yeah.
Till I had my own catering business. So, you know, dreams are, that's what prompted me to write this book.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yes, yes.
Well, I'm telling you,
unlocking
I'm
the
sure
secret
that
of
our
memory.
Listeners are quite fascinated with, you know, because... Mickey, you know that a lot of people in our age group and even younger are not you know, at the level that you are in terms of even the life you have lived.
I know, my dear.
That there's old people who never lived.
And there's so much to tell you, but I cannot get off this phone without I tell you something. Two things.
Okay.
One is the wedding procession in Jamaica. We don't see it anymore. But at the reception, they bake the cake a little outside of town. And that Saturday evening, you'll have maybe 8 or 10 ladies dressed in white angled dresses, plaid apron, tie head, and each one have a cake on their head with white gloves, marching single file through town, back up with a wedding cake in the back, the 3-tier cake or 4-tier cake.
Wow.
And you don't see
that
anymore.
Is something. Are there any pictures in existence?
I don't know, my dear.
That?
If anybody have any pictures out there. Another
wow,
one
that
is,
would be beautiful to have.
I know. Quickly, I'll tell you. Another one is 14 Barnett Street in Montego Bay, the dreaded jail. and the jail is built like, well, you know, the jail in Kingston on Queen Street there, big high walls.
Uh-huh.
And every Wednesday morning, crowds would line up outside the big, tremendous gate for the gate to open.
Uh-huh.
And the scene is of poor people. Maybe they're criminals, they're thieves or what have you, all chained together, 20, 30, with the policemen in their stiff black red seam and white tunic and bowly hat.
Uh-huh.
And they marched them in the street. They didn't have cars or vans to take them to the courthouse. Marched them down Barney Street, down St. James' Street, all the way down to the courthouse. Crowds gathering on both sides to see the people. And then the same thing when they're coming back in the evenings. And then the same thing when they go to prison on Saturday mornings, they have to go, or Friday mornings, they had to go to the railway station. So they march them again. It's a scene.
So where was the prison in another town?
No, the prison was in Spanish Town or Kingston.
Oh, so they would have to go by train from Montego Bay.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, no, this is after they've been convicted.
That's after they can be convicted.
Interesting.
And if
I
somebody
if
who belonged to...
any drawings of all
if
those
If somebody
things.
Ever belonged to the high nose, people would jeer them. Oh, put yourself in
wow.
their place. It would be murder. They died several times. They must have died several times.
Very interesting.
Nobody don't want to talk to me?
I don't, you know, we have a lot of listeners on the board, but most of my fans just like to listen. But
okay.
I would invite anyone who would like to interact. Ooh, I see two hands go up at the same time. So the first one I'm going to open is 718-379. And give me a minute. Your mic is open. Welcome to the backyard. This is Margaret. And Nikki, who do we have?
This is Lay in the Bronx, home of the New York Yankees.
Hi.
Hey, Mickey, how are you?
I am fine, my friend.
This is a very, very interesting dialogue you there.
We're getting an echo. Are you on a phone or something?
Excuse me?
We're getting a feedback.
I hear that myself, so it looks... Can
Maybe
you hear me
turn
now?
Turn down your computer.
Are you on your computer?
No, my computer is on, but not with you.
Okay. I'm interested to hear what you say.
Well, some of those names that you mentioned, Fletchers and the Harts, and I think their sons or whoever. Were contemporaries of mine, and I swam as my main sport at St. George's College.
Yes.
And I swam against these guys, you know. all these names that went to Cornwall College, your nemesis. And Miss Rod's daughter.
Yes.
She gave me a couple of cane licks down at that school.
Yes.
She was a tyrant, man.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was a quick resume of some of the things that you mentioned that I associated with.
Thank you, my friend. Go get my books, please.
Yes. So keep up the good work, man.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Lay from the Bronx. I'm going to close your mic since we have such a bad, some hookup
yes,
is bad.
Right.
Thanks
right.
for calling in. Hold on, and I'm going to welcome another caller from 718-379. Your mic is open. This is Margaret and Mickey. Welcome to the backyard.
Hello?
Hello?
Is anyone there? 718-379?
That's the same number you called before.
Oh, I see. It was open twice, so
okay.
I suppose that's why it was. We had that disturbance. Anyway, I mean, it's just been an exciting evening and a great way to reconnect. I want to thank all my callers on the board who called in. I really hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did. And Mickey, I just want to thank you for being our guest. And for sharing the stories with the world, because you know we have fans all over the world. They're Jamaicans that are scattered all over the world who tune in to Backyard Lab.
Yes, yes.
And also we have foreigners who just you know want to know more about Jamaica. And as I say, we're not here to you know say what is right, what is wrong, discuss politics. We just want to leave some memories of
Jamaica
as we knew it.
Yes, yes.
So
I really
appreciate and thank you for contributing.
I enjoyed it. I think I enjoyed it more than you. I enjoyed it very much.
No, you didn't enjoy it more than me. I enjoyed it a lot. So we enjoyed it together. And you're welcome to come back at any time. And please tell your friends that I will send you a link.
Yes.
Once the show is archived, so you can send it around to anyone you like that would love to hear the discussion that you made today. And, of course, all our shows are archived, so if anyone actually click on the link that I send them, you will be at the Blog Talk website.
All
and right there on the website, all of the shows are listed that we do each month. So if you just open up a month, you can decide which one you want to listen to. You can also, I'm talking to all our listeners, you can also copy that URL and send it to someone. Also, you can visit our website, which is www.backyardlabrish.com, and for those people who might not know how a labrish is spelled, it's L-A-B-R-I-S-H, just like it sounds. So with that said, Mickey, do you have some parting words for us?
Keep well, stay straight, and always look on the larger picture.
Amen.
Whatever the problem is, look on the bigger picture.
Right.
You'll find your seed.
We shall pass, whatever it is. And, you know, down here in the South, sometimes I listen to country music.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a country song that says, you know, if you're going through hell, keep on moving.
Yes.
You know, don't slow down because you'll get out of it before the devil even know you're there.
Yes, my dear, it's
song.
Been my pleasure. I really enjoy this evening, and I look forward to speaking with you again and tell you more stories.
Okay.
And your guests. Okay.
Well, I want to thank you, and I want to thank all my listeners. And we're live again. So next week we're gonna have another interesting show. And I'm always open to suggestions. So send me an email. Go to the website and send me an email, and let me know how you like the show, what you'd like us to labrish about. And you're always welcome to participate. So with that said, Mickey, I want to thank you and keep up the good work. You are an example of what you can do when you set your mind to it. And, you know, we have a lot of senior citizens all over the world, not just Jamaicans. I mean, yes. Just, you know, the baby boomers are aging. And a lot of them do not want, a lot of us, I have to say, do not want to embrace the new technology.
Yes,
and
yes.
I am here to encourage the seniors to embrace the technology. Believe you me, you know, it is interesting.
Open
it
up
is
a
intriguing.
New world.
It's not as difficult as you may think. So I know that some people don't want to do email. They don't want to get a computer. They don't want to learn how to work their computers. But if they just put their minds to it, if they want to, they can do it. So I signed, and I'll just quickly tell you, Mickey, and some of the listeners that might not know, I had a lot of precious things that were gifted to me by my mother, you know, letters,
mm-hmm.
pictures, artifacts.
Yes.
And I had a house fire. Everything
oh, no.
was destroyed.
Oh, no.
I'm still going through some things, trying to piece things together.
Yes,
so
yes.
here's my point. The show we're doing now will never be erased from cyberspace.
It's unique because nobody's doing this.
It will never be erased from cyberspace. Long after we're gone, someone can Google something, and who knows, it might come up. So I am doing this. I consider it leaving a legacy for the next generation, and especially my three precious grandsons that I'm blessed with.
Yes,
and they're
yes.
very young, and I am
Indeed.
Very old.
You're not old, my dear.
Yes,
not
but
old.
I mean in age. But my eldest is just, he's going to be 8 in October.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my youngest is going to be 6. So, you know, it's I want them to learn something about how I grew up, where I grew up, what life was like, because everything that is being done now, any part of the world, is online. You know, it's on
of
YouTube,
course, of course.
You know, it's on MySpace, whatever. But there's hardly any information in any culture about, you know, the 30s and 40s from
right.
the people who lived it. And I find now when I research people from 18 this and 17 that, it's
mm-hmm.
somebody else writing about them. Of
yes.
course, they did not have this technology, and a few of them wrote, because we have, you know, this book that some man was keeping a diary, a slave owner actually was keeping a diary
mm-hmm.
in the 1800s, you know, 1700s.
Yes.
And it was found. It was found by a professor at the university, or located. It wasn't lost. It was in the, you know, ownership
mm-hmm.
of a very prominent lord, or, you know, one of royalty.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
they got permission
mm-hmm.
to.
Hello?
I only have a few seconds left, but
yes.
it's called In Miserable Slavery. And
uh-huh.
this is a rewrite of that documentation.
Yes.
So my
yes.
point is, we have our own stories, and we need to document our own stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a wonderful device to do it.
Indeed,
so
indeed.
So with that said, I want to thank you again, Mickey, for sharing with us. I want to thank all the listeners on the board. I want to thank you for being loyal to Backyard Lavish. And as I always say, make it a great week. And we'll see you next week. Bye.
Okay, madam. Bye. Bye-bye.